I'm here to perform on Friday night at the Performance Hall with my pianist from Michigan. We're going to be doing the cello music of Richard Stohr, who was a Jewish Viennese composer, early to mid-20th century, exiled by the Nazis in 1938 when they took over Austria. And I've been performing this music for the last few years. I really think it's fantastic music, and that's why I'm going all over the country like this, doing these recitals.
How did you get in contact with his music, or how did you, did his family show it to you and say, hey, you might be interested in this?
Yes. I had met his grandson through mutual friends. His grandson's an attorney in Chicago, and we were introduced to one another because his grandfather's a composer and I'm a musician. So at the time, he didn't really know the full extent even of his grandfather's compositional output. And his words to me were, I think my grandfather might have written some music for cello. And so I looked into it, found a list of compositions, and found, he already knew where the compositions were housed, which is in Vermont, at a library there. So I got in touch with the library. They sent me the music, and the rest is history. As soon as I started playing it, even without hearing the piano parts, I knew that I wanted to perform this music and that people should hear it.
And was he a friend of yours, and that's why he said to you, you know, maybe you're the one that I want to show this to? Or how did you become, you know, why are you and not a different cellist?
I think I was just the first cellist that he met. He had already, the grandson this is, had already produced a CD of string quartet and piano music with musicians that he met through other people. And so, you know, I sort of became the cellist of choice to try out the cello music. And since then, there's a violinist over in Austria who's playing some of the violin music. There's a trumpet player in New York who's playing his trumpet concerto. And so, you know, gradually different musicians are taking up the cause and trying to get his music performed again.
That's really cool. And when was the music created originally? When did he write the music?
I'll be playing two pieces on Friday. The first is four fantasy pieces, which are just a sort of a suite of four short pieces. Lovely, just lyrical, you know, sort of Schumann-esque pieces. Those were written in 1907. And then there's a full-length cello sonata, which was written in 1915, just over 100 years ago now. And that is all the music that he wrote for cello and piano. It's about an hour's worth of music altogether.
Isn't that amazing that that's, you know, 100 years ago? I mean, that's just unbelievable to me.
Yeah, the cello sonata is a particularly interesting story because Stohr had been trained originally as a doctor. He actually got his MD degree from the University of Vienna, which was a top music, medical school at the time. And his father was actually on faculty there. So as he came to university age, his father convinced him that he should become a doctor instead of a musician. But after he graduated from medical school, he went straight into the Vienna Academy of Music, probably at the prompting of his uncle Heinrich, who was a famous musician in Germany and Austria. And so he then got a doctorate in music. So he had both an MD and a PhD in his two chosen fields, but he became an instructor and a composer, was on faculty at the Vienna Academy of Music. So when World War I broke out, the Austro-Hungarian Army actually drafted him as a doctor because he had medical training, even though he had never practiced medicine. So he was treating soldiers, actually, in a hospital in Vienna. And it was during that time that he wrote this cello sonata. So different people hear different things in the sonata, but listeners might actually hear a little bit of world events that were going on in the sonata. There's a little bit of martial music, and there's just a lovely slow movement that to me feels like the world that he knew was slipping away. He knew the world was going to be very different after World War I, no matter who won or lost. And so it's kind of a nostalgic elegy to the world that he knew in Vienna before the war, I believe.
That's fascinating. Yeah, so this guy lived through both the world wars.
Yes, oh yes, he did.
And was he still making music when after being exiled and all mm-hmm. that stuff?
Yes, he came. He actually came to the United States in 1939. He was one of the lucky ones who was able to get a passport, and you also had to have a firm offer of employment in your chosen country in order to get out of Nazi Germany. And Austria at that time was Nazi Germany. So he had an offer of employment from the Curtis Institute of Music in Philadelphia, which was then and still is one of our great music schools in the U.S. And the offer was from Mrs. Mary Bach Curtis herself, the founder of the school. And I've seen the letter that she wrote to him, offering him. He had a job offer just as music librarian. They didn't really even have a faculty position for him yet. But as soon as he got here, got to Philadelphia, they realized how much he could do, and so they had him then teaching courses just as he had been in Vienna. He had been teaching the highest level composition courses. He was head of the department in Vienna when he was fired. And so he then taught for a few years at Curtis, and then they had to downsize because of the war and reduced enrollment, so that's how he ended up in Vermont, teaching at a small Catholic college there and also at a small conservatory, and sort of cobbling things together to make ends meet during the war.
So it's possible that the...
I'm sorry, I never actually answered your question, though, whether he continued to write music in the U.S. He, in fact, did. And, in fact, his output... increased after he came to the United States from the early 1900s to 1938, when he was fired from his job. He wrote about 70 major works, 70 opus numbers, symphonies, you know, large chamber works, choral works, piano works, and then when he was able to start composing again around 1940 or 41, until the mid to late 50s, when he finally stopped composing, he composed about another 60 or 70 opus numbers, major works, many of which have actually never been performed, because some of them are symphonies, which he wrote in manuscript and then was never able to get them published or get parts made or even for it to become possible for them to be performed. So there's a whole lot of music in that library in Vermont that nobody's ever heard. And so I'm hoping that other musicians will take this up, because it's probably not going to even happen in my lifetime, you know, that we hear all of this music. It's an enormous project.
Yeah, that's remarkable. And I was wondering, you know, because you said he was only able to get the passport to come to the United States because of the letter that mm-hmm. guaranteeing employment, that's possible that saved his life, right?
It did save his life, actually, because at the time when the Nazis first took over Austria, the idea of mass extermination of the Jews hadn't really – I'm sure they had thought of it, but they hadn't acted on it yet. So the idea was simply to get rid of the Jews, to force them out, to – silence them, and so that's what happened to Richard Stohr. And in fact, I mean, if you think about it, he was effectively silenced. I mean, his music was never really performed in the German-speaking world after that, and just a handful of performances in the English-speaking world where he went. But he had an older sister who was not able to get out of Vienna. And she actually did perish in the Holocaust in 1942. So I think it's fairly certain that the same thing would have happened to him if he had not been able to leave.
Yeah, wow. That's an amazing story. So where all are you traveling to do these performances?
Next month, actually, in March, I am going to Vermont, to the University of Vermont, and also to a Unitarian church in Montpelier, and we'll be giving performances there. And so Storr's family will actually be in attendance. His daughter still lives there in Montpelier. She's 88 years old, sharper than you and me put together. And I'm really, really excited to be going there to perform the music with her in attendance, and also her children and grandchildren, I hope, will be there. I've performed the music in New Orleans, in Chicago, all over the place in Michigan. I've performed in Ohio. And so I'm just trying to play it everywhere I can. And not just the cello music. I've developed other programs as well. I perform one of his string quartets with a group of fine musicians back in Ann Arbor, Michigan. And I also have just started performing a piano trio for piano, violin, and cello, which I love very much. And I've got performances of that this coming spring also, but that's in Michigan.
Is that where you're based?
I'm based in Ann Arbor, Michigan,
oh, okay,
yes.
Okay, cool. That's where my father and grandfather went to Ann Arbor.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, so I try to pay attention. My dad watched all the football games. They played in Salt Lake City this year.
That's right, and lost, as I recall.
Yeah, that was one of the only games that they lost because they couldn't figure out who they wanted to start at quarterback. They didn't disclose it until like they walked out on the field.
I see.
And then that guy that they did pick was really good, though.
All right. Well, you know more about it than I do.
Yeah, I do. I do follow football a lot. So would you have interest? You don't have plans to go to Europe to perform the music, but would you have interest in doing that?
Actually, I have. I should have mentioned in my list of places that I've been. In December of 2014, I had the privilege of performing some of this music, not all of it, in Mannheim, Germany, and also in Vienna, Austria. So that was with a different pianist than you'll be hearing on Friday night. There was a pianist in Mannheim who has taken an interest in Storr's music, and he invited me to come and perform with him on a recital of Storr's music that he was doing. And then we took some of that music to Vienna, and we actually performed it on Vienna, on Austrian radio. And that was a tremendous privilege, and it's so exciting to be back in Storr's hometown and to be bringing his music back to his hometown, where he's really almost unknown. And it's such a shame. There are a few people there who know who he is. He's still remembered at the school, actually, at the academy. There are people there who know him from his reputation as a teacher and as a composer, but the musical public at large really doesn't know him very well at all. But I would love to go back to Europe and perform his music some more, absolutely.
Yeah, I mean, that's really interesting to me that to go back to Austria and Germany and, you know, just because of all the sentimentality attached to that. When you play in a place like that, does it feel different to you than it, you know, when you play in the United States and these other places? Or?
Oh yeah, absolutely. Just the culture of concert going is different there. It's going to classical concerts is just much more sort of an everyday occurrence, and especially in Vienna. I mean, there are literally dozens of concerts going on every day in Vienna. You can go somewhere. Yeah, you just have your choice of what to go to in Vienna to hear. So it's just part of it. It's just in the air all the time there. And so the audiences are you know, informed, and they've heard a lot of music, and they're curious. They want to know more. Especially the audience in Mannheim just really was very taken with the music and very interested in knowing more and curious as to why they had never heard of this guy. I think in Austria, there's still, how do I want to say this, a bit of lingering guilt and denial as to, you know, they're trying to portray themselves as the victims of Nazi oppression, but there was a large segment of society that welcomed the coming of the Nazis, and they know it. I mean, they know it. So they were actually not quite as welcoming as the audience in Germany. It's very interesting.
In what way? How did you sense that?
Well, the concert in Vienna was way more difficult to set up than the one in Germany. I mean, there was just a resistance to the whole idea. I had to negotiate a lot to get it to happen, and I just sensed that they didn't want to hear the story as much as the folks in Germany did. You know, I think Germans are more at, not at peace, but they've sort of dealt with the guilt and acknowledged it, and they actually want to do something about it, you know. Whereas in Austria, the approach is they just want to portray themselves as victims, you know. So
that's really interesting.
Maybe that's harsh, and maybe it's not entirely correct. I'm sure there are people out there who would interpret history differently than I just have, but that was my sense of it. And, you know, what I know, I'm not a historian. What I know about all this is what I've read in books and talking to, you know, musical historians and so forth. So I don't claim to know everything about this, but you asked my opinion, my impression, and those are my impressions.
Yeah, and you're the one that went there and was setting up the show, and I mean, you have a unique perspective on it, and you're going around honoring this guy, his legacy, and just so you can see how different people
react
to it.
At the time I was negotiating to do the concert in Vienna was just at the time that some really embarrassing revelations were coming out about the Vienna Philharmonic and their relationship with Nazism, and the whole big cache of paintings that had been looted from Jews had just been discovered in Munich. And so it was just kind of in the air, and there was just kind of a defensiveness about it all at the time that was noticeable to me.
Do you feel, I mean, you clearly have admiration for how do you say it? Stör. Stör. I think it's kind of cool bringing kind of this spiritual kind of connection, this resurrection of these things that didn't get to happen. That, I mean, like, do you ever think, I wonder what, if he were looking at me and looking down, I wonder what he would think about this and like daydream about that?
I think about it often. I do. I really wish I could have known him, because I've been very privileged to have access to his diaries, his letters, his personal effects, obviously his music, his collection of photographs. And so I have, I think, a pretty rich sense of the type of man he was. And I would have loved to talk to him and learn from him about music and about his music especially, but what he also knew about everybody else's music. So, yeah, I feel a responsibility to get this right, because I think that a tremendous injustice was done to him. And as I said before, you know, the Nazis simply wanted to silence him. And in a sense, they got what they wanted. And not to make it sound too grandiose, but, you know, I just don't want to live in a world where that can happen to an artist, you know. To a musician, silence is tantamount to death, you know. And I think he would have gladly given years off the end of his life, many years off the end of his life, if he could have known that his music would still be performed. So that's not how it worked out. So it's up to us now to do it. And if audiences really, really respond to this music. It's, even though it was written in the 20th century, it's not 20th century music. It's 19th century music. So it's very romantic, very melodic, very dramatic, and very powerful. And this is not actually the first time that I've performed this music in Logan. I've performed some of it in the summer in that performance hall in connection with the Utah Festival opera and musical theater where I work in the summers. And so I've already performed it for audiences here, and they loved it. So I'm really glad to have the chance to come back during the school year, where the sort of year-round Logan community and the music students and students on campus will have a chance to hear it as well.
You're sort of a unique activist of sorts, which I think is very, really cool.
It didn't start out that way. I just liked the music when I heard it at first. And then I wanted to know more about the guy who wrote it, just out of curiosity. And the importance, you know, the sort of importance that I'm, you know, attaching to it now sort of grew up later on when I realized how awful it would be for him to know how little his music is being performed now. And so, reputations come and go. Different composers have had periods where their music wasn't performed. And now we think how awful that was. You know, Bach wasn't performed for many years. Schubert wasn't performed for many years. Mahler's music wasn't performed for a long time, for different reasons. In Mahler's case, it was part of the reason was because he was Jewish. And that's really what it boils down to for Richard Stuhr. You know, if he hadn't been Jewish, we'd probably be playing his music much more today than we do. So,
but you're
well, I'm trying to do my part. I'm trying to do my part. I feel as though this thing sort of came to me almost out of the sky, really. You know, it was, I'm just very fortunate that I ever heard of him at all. And once I started performing the music and audiences were really responding to it, I felt, you know, that I had a responsibility to expose as many people as possible to his music while I can. It's one thing I can do for this guy, you know.
Tell me when the show is and...
The show is at 7:30 on Friday at the Performance Hall on campus at Utah State University. And I believe it is free for students and $10 for general admission. And I should say that you won't, if you come, and I hope you do come, you won't just hear the music. I also do a sort of visual presentation about Stuhr's life. I have a PowerPoint presentation where I show photographs and documents, which are very interesting and bring his life story to life. And so you get to really understand a lot more about the man. And then when you hear the music, the two things just kind of feed off of each other. I try to keep the talking part as succinct as possible. But since I had access to all this material, I felt that a visual presentation would actually add a lot to the recital experience. And the first time I did this with the PowerPoint presentation was actually at the Holocaust Museum in Skokie, Illinois, which is one of the more famous Holocaust museums in the country. And the positive response I got to the combination of the visual with the music just convinced me that that's the way to do it from then on.
Yes, I mean, you're really a multimedia artist over here. Multimedia artist, activist, historian. You got a lot going on.
It's the project just keeps growing larger and larger. We do have a website now. If people want to sort of study up a little bit beforehand, you just have to Google Richard Stuhr's name and the website will come up. I created the website in conjunction with the family with the full permission and blessing. And so all the images that are on there are from the family's collections and also the collection at the library in Vermont. And some of those things I will be using in my PowerPoint presentation. But on the website, one thing that's there that I can't do in a recital is there's a lot more music that you can actually hear on the website. Bits of his commercial recordings, or the commercial recordings that have been made, the few commercial recordings that have been made, there are excerpts of those. And then there are actually some archival tapes that were in his collection, reel-to-reel tapes, and actually in even some old 78s that we had digitized so that we could hear what was on them. And we've selected the best performances off of those, and those are available to hear on the website. So that might be a good thing for people to do either before or after they come to the recital and to learn a little more, hear a little bit more of Richard Stewart's music.
Yeah, definitely. Cool.
It's interspersed.
Okay.
So I do sort of part one of his life, and then we play the first piece, and then I kind of do part two of his life, and then we play the cello sonata.
Oh, I love that.
So
yeah.
So it's, you get a balance. It's not just like a whole big chunk of talking and then a whole big chunk of music.
Yeah.
It breaks it up a little more. But the images aren't like running while I'm playing the music. You know, it's like we focus on the music when it's time to play the music.
Okay, I misunderstood that a little bit. But yeah, I could see it working both ways. But
right,
you know.
Right. I'm gonna think if there's anything else I should tell you. Robert and I do have I have a wonderful collaborator who's flying in from Michigan tomorrow, my pianist, Robert Conway. He's professor at Wayne State University in Detroit and is orchestral keyboardist with the Detroit Symphony and also a very active and busy performer doing all sorts of other things besides my program and his work with the symphony. He and I have been working on this for several years now, and we actually have a CD of the music. All the music that will be heard on Friday night is available on the CD, and the CD will be available to purchase at the recital. If you don't purchase it there, you know, it can be gotten on Amazon and iTunes and all those other ways of buying music nowadays.
And what's the name of it?
It's called Richard Stewart Chamber Music Volume 1, I believe.
Okay, I saw that when I looked up stuff, yeah.
Yeah. And there hasn't yet been a Chamber Music Volume 2, but I believe that the record label would like to bring out more, you know, if people record more of his music, they'd like to have it as sort of a series. So they've nicely set it up for there to be a sequel and a part 3 and so forth. But I can't say enough about Robert Conway and the work he's done helping me with this, because the piano parts are really quite difficult. Stewart was a pianist, a very good pianist, and there are recordings of him playing the piano on the website, so you can actually hear how good he was. And the piano parts are just very, very difficult, and so I need the best pianist I can get to bring these works to life properly, and that they can be heard the way Stewart wanted them to be heard. So I'm just so pleased that Robert's been working with me on this, and I'm very excited for Logan and Utah State University to get to hear him play.